Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
Hi folks, welcome to the JewelCast. It is 11:05 p.m. on April 18th. That is about a half hour after the end of Game 3. If you were watching, you know how it ended. If you haven't been watching, we got a lot to catch you up on. So we're not only going to talk about Game 3, a 2-1 overtime win for the Kings, but we're going to talk about the two games before as well. In order to be polite to our guest, Jake, the editor of Fear the Finn. Let's get him on the line.
Really should put a trigger warning or something on that intro you guys have. Maybe I could have called afterwards.
Jake, welcome. Good talking
Hi.
To you.
That's always a pleasure.
Well, yeah, we only included the finals one, so nothing to hopefully trigger direct memories. But
no, that's
anyway,
true. I did not watch either of them, so fair enough.
Yeah.
Right.
It's good to have
you. Right. Okay,
again.
Let's go. I'm ready.
Oh, you're ready. You're ready. You want to talk now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, let's go.
So we're going to start with Game 3 because it just happened and because our audience is primarily Kings fans, but Sharks fans, if you're listening, welcome.
God bless you.
Thanks
every single
listening.
One of you.
Congratulations on winning the series. So Game 3. I guess first impressions. What did you think of I'll talk about the Kings in a second, but what did you think of the Sharks' performance today?
Yeah, I think they played okay. I think that's, you know, probably the most you can say. I don't know. You know, it's kind of the game that I expected this entire series was going to be. I think the Kings played their game a little bit more than they did in the first two games. It was a lot slower. There were a lot of stretches where both teams had no shot attempts to speak of. I think that, you know, that the fourth line of the Sharks struggled a lot more than it had the first two games. I think Quick played much, much better, or at least got luckier, whatever. In goaltending, there's not really much of a difference as far as I'm concerned, so whatever. So I think that was kind of the difference. I think the Sharks played fine. You know, this, like, in a series like this, I think most games are going to be pretty much 50-50, and one team's going to win by one goal. And that's pretty much how these series have gone. I mean, really, the past forever, right? All of these series have been pretty much like this. So, you know, I'm not really surprised.
Yeah, and I do like the implication that the Kings liked this better because it was a more boring game for large stretches. And it's kind of true.
Well,
although
it's true. I mean, you know, like, I know it's a thing that neutrals and maybe I'll complain about, but, you know, whatever. I mean, if you're going to, if that's what you need to do to win hockey games, that's absolutely what you should do. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem with it from, like, a, you know, technical standpoint or whatever. I think it's boring,
sure.
But you know, I don't know. I'd be perfectly fine with a boring style that wins cups.
And I think the Kings couldn't possibly have been less bored in the third period when they were busy going, I think, 14 minutes and 58 seconds without a shot on goal. Obviously, you can blame two power plays for that, but needless to say, the Kings were kind of hanging on for dear life after a game in which I would say, and I don't think anybody would disagree with their best in the series so far.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, especially, I mean, really after that Kopitar goal, you know, I don't really buy into the idea that, you know, the, like, momentum shifted or anything like that, but they certainly just, yeah, I mean, that last, whatever it was, what, like, 12 minutes of that first period were, that's, in my opinion, the best they've played in the entire series. You know, wasn't even close. I think from there, the Sharks had the better of the play. But, you know, like, it's so, it's, other really than that one Sharks power play where, you know, they did everything but score. You know, it was pretty even. I think basically the Sharks' first line had some really good chances, and then, you know, the kind of more of the Kings' bottom lines had more of the better opportunities. I think that's just kind of where the mismatches are right now because the Sharks are overloading that top line. So I think that makes sense.
Yeah, and there's, at least from the Kings' postgame, there was a lot of talk about the penalty kills for both teams, at least especially for the Kings in the third period. But I think this was sort of a resounding win for the power plays, even though there was only one power play goal, and that was Kopitar's in the first period. The Kings had a terrific power play at the end of the second where maybe the buzzer might have prevented them from getting a couple more really good chances. And then, of course, there was the back-to-back ones in the third period where Kopitar breaks a stick, and it's a lot of people spinning around in circles.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I know that this is a game where people are going to talk about, oh, man, the penalty kills were huge. And both the penalty kills were garbage. They were bad. They just weren't very good. And that's, you know, I think what's kind of incredible is that the biggest difference to me in this series from any other series is that it's like when the Kings go on the power play, it's like, oh, my God, it's actually scary now. Which isn't, I don't mean that as like a criticism of what the Kings were before, but that just wasn't really their game. And now watching them on the power play, I mean, it's, this is not the same Kings power play that I've been, you know, very used to watching for, you know, whatever, the past 5-6 years. So I think that's kind of really interesting. And I think that's like really the biggest area they've improved this year.
And the Kings finished 8th on the power play this season. They were at various points in the top 3 in the NHL, which I think is where the Sharks finished, was number 3.
Mm-hmm.
But after Vincent Lecavalier came over, he went on a hot streak. The Kings power play went on a hot streak. And it actually, for the last month of the season or so, they sort of had trouble getting it going. But game 3 is a very different story.
I think even the first two games, that Kings power play has looked good, even when it hasn't necessarily scored. Part of that is the Sharks' penalty kill is very, very bad this year. It's just, it is not good at all. I know that makes it tough to separate, like, well, how much is it the Kings are really good versus the Sharks' penalty kill bad, whatever. I think that even despite not necessarily, you know, whatever. I think even still, what are they, 3 for 12, 13, something like that? That's still pretty good in, you know, the NHL in 2016. You know, this isn't, it's not the 80s anymore.
Yeah, 20% gets you into the top 10, then you can't be disappointed.
Exactly. I think, 18% is like the median, whatever percentage? I mean,
maybe, yeah.
And it might be lower than that. Yeah, right, exactly. So there you go.
So looking at some of the ice times in the third period, the third period and the entire game, that was a big topic of discussion here. Drew Doughty, of course, finished with, I think, 34 minutes, 38 seconds at the expense of Braden McNabb, who only played 10 minutes, Jamie McBain, who didn't even hit 6. Versteeg and Clifford kind of got stapled to the bench down the stretch, although they're fellow fourth line mate, whether that be Lewis or King, both of them got some important shifts down the stretch. On the Sharks side, Spaulding, which I assume most Sharks fans are happy with, didn't play a lot down the stretch. Tierney and Wingles also were very lightly used. At the other end, Burns had 27 minutes. Pavelski played 24 and Thornton played 24. Which I think only got matched by Kopitar in terms of forwards.
Yeah, I think part of that has to do with the it seemed just like with good fortune, I think, that there were a lot of TV timeouts at opportune times. And yeah, I think the Sharks got a little lucky and were able to really put that Thornton line back out there again and again and again. And to me, that's always been kind of one of the big keys to this series is that Thornton line has to be dominant, and it was tonight, just the way it has been all season. They're definitely the Corsi leaders, I think, for the entire game. I know for sure for the Sharks that in all situations, it's something crazy like, you know, plus 20-something or other for Thornton, which is, you know, insane.
Right.
And then I think like a plus 10 or whatever at even strength. So, yeah, that doesn't surprise me that much. The weird Spaulding obsession is kind of strange to me, especially given that the guy who's being – put in the press box for him is you know, Dinah Zubris, who was a guy who literally got signed because, you know, he's cool with Peter DeBoer, right, from New Jersey. And then they make this weird trade for Spalling, which, you know, was weird and bad. And then I don't know what it is about him that, you know, has made DeBoer, you know, choose to roll with him instead of with Zubris. I assume that this game, much like, you know, poor Nick Shore, Spalling's going to be the sacrificial lamb heading into game four. He will not be playing again. I mean, even when, you know, Mike Brown was a thing in San Jose, in the games where Brown would have, you know, whatever, countless bad minor penalties, he would sit for a while. So I assume we'll see the same thing again here.
Right. And with the you mentioned the Thornton line, which I think we have to talk about. I think it's been the story of the series so far, even with the Kings getting back into it tonight. They, I don't know how much they were matched up against the Carter, Toffoli, Lucic line, but they got plenty of shifts against them. And that Carter, Toffoli, Lucic line, it's definitely the most frequently used combination for the Kings this season. It's probably been their most consistent one. And they got pretty much mauled at even strength. Carter was the worst Corsi player for either team at even strength, which is not something you say about Jeff Carter very much. So it's been a puzzle the entire series for the Kings, who finally this year we saw Thornton and Kopitar go head-to-head a lot, and Kopitar doesn't lose head-to-head battles with many players, and he lost it with Thornton so far this year. So the Kings maybe found some success without that matchup occurring the entire game, but they also, you know, they give up a goal on the very first shift against those guys, and the rest of the game, they're threatening.
Yeah. I think it's kind of interesting because, yeah, while I agree that Thornton has been, you know, has outplayed the Kopitar line, that to me has been, you know, kind of a difference in the series. So tonight, looking at it, I think that, you know, they played a lot against, right, that Lucic line, which was very effective when playing against, you know, the second or third Sharks line. And that obviously, I think that, you know, while the Thornton line, you know, vastly outplayed them, I think that you're taking that, you know, it's happening on the other end, too, where Kopitar doesn't have to play against Thornton anymore. So I don't really know how much of a difference that makes. You know, I mean, I assume it's kind of a wash, right? You know, I don't know. Yeah, so, like, the Sharks' best line gets to play against the not-best Kings line. The best Kings line gets to play against the not-best Sharks line. So I wonder how much of a difference that actually makes, the whole scheme of things. I think the most concerning thing, if I was a Kings fan, would be how many minutes they got, like, with Rob Scuderi on the ice. This is one of the weirdest things for me about Daryl Sutter is his weird, this Rob Scuderi experience that seems to be going on. I think that's him and Doughty. Those are the two defensemen that the Thornton line saw the most, and that seems to be just not a good idea. You're playing with fire there. Scuderi is not good at, I mean, really much of anything anymore, and I would definitely not want him, you know, out there against that top line. But personally, I don't know. I don't know if that's a DeBoer, you know, causing that matchup to happen, or if it's just by chance, or what the deal is. But that, I think, is an area that the Sharks should look to exploit, even if they're not doing it intentionally.
I think it's a combination of things. I think that it has a lot to do with DeBoer finding that matchup. I think it has a lot to do with the defensive depth, and that's, again, two big challenges LA during the playoffs. Number one is dealing with the Thornton line, and number two is how to match up the defense so you don't have a pair that's just getting slaughtered. And we saw Doughty and McNabb for the first two games. We saw Muzzin, then usually with Shen, I believe, and then Scuderi sort of left with the minutes at the bottom. And Sutter decided to put Drew Doughty with Rob Scuderi, giving Scuderi a lot more responsibility, but also allowing Muzzin to anchor that other pair. And then McNabb, again, not getting very many minutes with what we're calling the Mick pairing, with McNabb and McBain. And it worked in terms of goals against. I think Scuderi was better than he's been in the first two games, which your mileage may vary there. But Scuderi made a couple good plays. He made one really impressive play on Pavelski in front of the net that was something we haven't seen enough of from Scuderi for the role he's being asked to play. But Scuderi, he got his job done, the job being don't give up any goals, but it was, you know, it was hairy at times.
Right. I think that's really the thing, is that, you know, we in a one-game sample or whatever, we can say, oh, yeah, this, you know, the result is good. But I think if you actually look at the way that the play went, I think that that's kind of a dangerous thing. That being said, given that Doughty is obviously, you know, a defensive defenseman, which, you know, stupid term, but, it, you know, it works, kind of it matters less, because him covering for Scuderi doesn't hurt the Kings because they're so much, because they're not – it's not they're losing any offense. It's not Doughty's job anyway. I really like Jake Muzzin's game a lot. I mean, I've always liked his game. I think he's extremely good. I thought that, yeah, you know, having him on that kind of second pairing or whatever, I thought that he was pretty effective. The biggest advantage the Sharks have in the series is, you know, if Alec Martinez doesn't come back, because that's, you know, it's not an NHL team that can lose, you know, one of its, you know, better defensemen or whatever and really absorb that the way I think everyone's fans would like them to. You know, when Mark-Edward Vlasic's been hurt, when Paul Martin's been hurt this year, I mean, the hand-wringing is just incredible. It's if they expect a guy, you know, the AHL guy or the seventh defenseman to come in and do a job. And that's just not – it just doesn't work that way anymore. There's just not that there's not that many great defensemen out there. You just can't replace guys like that. And I think that, yeah, that, you know, is kind of an area of concern for the Kings.
Right. And I think – a lot of people have been asking for Kevin Gravel to be put in the lineup. Kevin Gravel being the AHL call-up who played probably 10 games, maybe 15 games for the Kings this season. And as much as Scuderi has struggled at times this season, there's no way that Daryl Sutter is going to play Gravel over Scuderi, and there's no way that he should. I think Gravel against that Thornton line, and Gravel has been decent for his first season, but putting him even for one shift against that Thornton line, and he's fishing the puck out of the net.
Yeah, I think that there were kind of similar calls for when with Dylan DeMello kind of filled in when Vlasic was hurt near the end of the season and then played pretty well. Granted, with a lot of offensive zone starts, a lot of sheltered minutes, which is not something that, you know, the average fan is looking at. You know, I don't hold that against anybody. That's fine. But I think that, you know, there were people who are like, oh, you know, who aren't really happy with the way Polak played, which, fair enough, he is not very good. In a series like, there's just no way an NHL coach is going to take a chance in either of these situations on an unproven AHL kid that's not, you know, some kind of a, you know, a Calder candidate or whatever. They're just not going to do it. They're not going to scratch a veteran over that guy. And, you know, you might not like that, whatever, but, you know, welcome to the NHL, man. There is not a coach in this league that is willing to put his job on that. That's the kind of thing you get fired for. It's not going to happen. So, you know, so it is.
Exactly. So we've talked about some of the bottom end guys now, at least, and you can go back to the first two games as well. Outside of that Thornton top line, who do you think has been the Sharks' best player in this series?
Probably, it's tough. I guess, you know, excluding the Brent Burns, who I kind of lump into that top unit, probably Logan Couture.
Sure.
You know, he's just the kind of guy that for one reason or another seems to be, you know, kind of underrated among the Sharks fan base. Because he's not, you know, he's not Thornton, he's not Pavelski or Vlasic or Burns even, but I think that having him in the lineup, that kind of depth that he provides is really, really valuable. And I think he's looked pretty good. I also think an important player, honestly, has been Patrick Marleau, who's basically rolling on babysitting duty on the third line. I mean, I think if you look at the, like, event summary or whatever for what he's been in the three games, like, but he's got to be one of the lowest event players out there. I think basically what he's doing is like, all right, go out there and soak up 50 seconds or whatever, and don't let them score or take any shots, but you're not going to get any either. And, you know, I think he's done a pretty good job doing that, and maybe that's the way, what needs to be done, just to, you know, like, all right, let's hold on for dear life until we can get that Thornton line back out there. So that's, for me, what I would say. Those two guys have probably been the most important, you know, depth players.
Mm-hmm. And Couture is interesting because the last few years, there's always been that sense of, when is Couture going to take over the team? And I think as a second-line center, I think he can be an NHL first-line center, but with Thornton ahead of him, it's a perfect place for Couture to thrive. And he doesn't have to be the center of the team. And it says something, I think, that the Sharks are more successful when he's not carrying the load.
I think part of the reason that comes up so often is really there's a sense that that's what he wants. You know, there's some guys like, you know, Joe Thornton does not, historically anyway, love being the guy. You know, that's never really been a thing he's cared about. Whereas Logan Couture, just his entire career, has been the guy that really seems like he desperately wants to be the guy somewhere. You know, he's the guy that's complained before about, you know, how much we've talked about, you know, the Nail Yakupovs of the world or the Taylor Halls. Like literally, he has done this on the record. So the idea that, like, when is Logan Couture going to take over this team isn't, like, me or a columnist saying it. It's Logan Couture saying it. It's like he's standing there like, hey, guys, when is it going to be my team? And, you know, Joe Thornton probably kind of looks at him and shakes his head and walks out of the room. You know, and I think that's kind of why that is a thing. But I think you're right. Joe Thornton's, you know, a first ballot Hall of Famer. Joe Pavelski is an incredibly gifted scorer. There's really no reason for them to break up what's been working on that top line. And I think the fact that he gets to play against, you know, not Anze Kopitar, that's good for Logan Couture, whether Logan Couture knows it or not. So, yeah.
Yeah, and as for Marlowe from this end, I haven't noticed him as much, obviously, because I am busy sighing in relief every time he's on the ice instead of Thornton. But I think this game especially, I saw it some jump from him. I've been an observer from afar, but for someone who is definitely slowed down with age a lot more than Thornton has, but so is everyone else in the NHL compared to Thornton, he definitely was a bit more dangerous tonight.
I think the thing is that he has played pretty well this series. He just doesn't have any line mates, quite frankly. He just doesn't. Yeah. The guys he's playing with just aren't really, you know, they're just not good. They can't. He is still, I would bet, the fastest player on the Sharks, which is incredible, obviously, given, you know, given his age and whatever. But yeah, I mean, right, exactly. And that's kind of why I'm calling it babysitting duty, because I think he's played pretty well. So like tonight, he had even strength. He is an even in Corsi, only 12. Even strength shot attempts for either team. That's pretty incredible, given a, you know, relatively speaking, how much, you know, he's on the ice for 18 minutes. That's, you know, not a high event guy. And so I think that's kind of the role he's in now. You know, overall, I'd say he hasn't really played all that well this season, and definitely you can see he's slowed down a bit, especially, of course, like you said, compared to Thornton. But yeah, you know, he's basically, you know, I guess in like soccer terms, I think of him as like, oh, he's the guy that, you know, does a job for the Sharks. He goes out and he puts in a shift or whatever, and, you know, he's doing what he needs to do, basically.
I was wondering how long it was going to take us to get to soccer, but we'll hold off on that so people can shut that off at the end if they want. So then, talking about games 1 and 2. I've heard a couple people say that the you know, it was 2-1 goal games. I've said that the Kings, maybe if they were able to escape those two games with 1-goal losses, then it was a good sign for when they actually did put in a full 60 minutes. And then there were some others who were purely saying that the Kings maybe could have gotten out of those two games with a win. Do you think there's any way that the Kings should have come out of that with a split?
I don't know about should have, but if that series had gone 1-1 or the first two games, I mean, would we really be able to say that those were unfair results? I mean, no, not really. I think part of the problem is that, you know, when you're looking at the numbers and we're remembering the game, we're thinking about those last 2 minutes, right, where the goalies pulled and the Kings had all those great chances.
Yeah.
I know we like to talk about that, like those are the same in quality and value as playing well the first 58 minutes, but they're really not. You know, the Kings historically are not a team that's like, oh, you know, we had to come back late with a goalie pulled or whatever. So I think that, to me, was, you know, that's, I guess, potentially concerning. But I don't know. In the playoffs, yeah, they've all been 1-goal games. And I think that, you know, this series could just as easily be 3-0 LA as it could be 3-0 Sharks, because that's just the way that these games have gone. I think, honestly, that, you know, if Jonathan Quick plays a little bit better those first two games, we're not talking about this. You know, it's a different situation entirely. So, yeah, sure. I could definitely see a scenario where they where they come back with a split in those games. I certainly don't think that coming into this that any Kings fan should have been, you know, like, oh, you know, that they just don't have it or they can't come. I mean, honestly, if there's a Kings fan who is concerned about their ability to come back in this series, then I don't know. I guess they're new to the team or new to the program.
And I think everyone was pretty realistic on the Kings' end that the series wasn't over. That, but it's hard to do that when you also don't feel like you deserve to win either game. And I think a lot of Kings fans were more positive than I was after game two. I was comfortable coming into this game. I felt like the Kings were going to win. At the very least, I felt like they were going to put in a much better game. But I also came out of game two thinking, man, there's no way the Kings should have been in that game. And it was more difficult to make that argument because the Kings had the better play for stretches, which they didn't really do in game one. But it was clear that they needed to change some things.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think to me, and I was talking to a friend about this, that what was most surprising to me about the Kings and Ducks being down 2-0 after the first two games is that for the large stretches that they got outplayed. It's hockey. There are tons of times where, God knows Kings fans have experienced this in the regular season where they just absolutely dominate, like the Oilers or whomever, and you end up losing. And that's just, right, and that's hockey and whatever. But that really, you couldn't argue that, the Kings really should have won either of those games as far as, with real confidence. It definitely could have. But, yeah, I think that to me was the most surprising thing, that it just felt like they didn't really play their game the way that they've been able to in the past. With it being so close, and, I felt like an adjustment was going to come. And I think that they did a much better job in game three of neutralizing that kind of dump and chase thing that the Sharks were able to do pretty well in the first two games, personally.
Mm-hmm. As for the Sharks going into game four, I was going to ask you what the sort of vibe was around the Sharks fan base, but I'd be surprised if it was anything other than being really pleased with the Kings play and also very cautious. But do you make any changes going into game four?
Other than putting Zubras in for Spalling, which I feel is like kind of a given. No, I mean, there's nothing else to change in my opinion. That Thornton line is very good. Maybe DeBoer will tinker with the other lines, but I think that would be silly. To me, it's tough to separate the way that the Sharks as a team, I think, will react fine. They'll be fine. They'll go into game four and feeling like they had a chance to win tonight. Sharks fan base is a whole other story. I mean, if people were nervous up 2-0, you should see them now. My mentions are just an absolute tire fire. There's a lot of anxiety and just, in general around this. I've got people telling me that the Sharks power play needs to be fixed. And honestly, if you watch those power plays tonight, an area of weakness. Yeah, right. Exactly. honestly, if there's someone on the staff who can make that power play more dangerous, then absolutely promote them, give them a raise. That sounds incredible. Whatever. Losing sucks, but I think that the Sharks have a really good veteran group that's going to be fine. And, other than subbing in Zubras, there's nothing else that really needs to be done, in my opinion.
Sure. So I'll answer this the other way after you do, but who do you think has been the Kings' best player so far in this series? And take your time, because it's not an easy question. I was trying to think about it myself, and I couldn't come up with an immediate answer other than maybe the obvious one.
I mean, man, that is actually pretty tough. I mean, I don't know. I mean, tonight I'd probably say Kopitar or somebody like that, but he hasn't been all that good in the first couple of games. Man, I know from like a possession standpoint, a guy like, I think like Trevor Lewis was good tonight. I don't know. Dustin Brown, I guess, was pretty good. I don't know. Who do you have?
Well, see, the first thought is Dowdy just because he's playing so much, but he also is.
He's played not very well those first two games, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
At the very least, on those goals against, he looked just not good. Not like him, yeah. You know?
So my answer actually was Trevor Lewis, and that is totally sincere.
Ooh,
and not just
we both said Trevor Lewis. That's nice.
Yeah,
great.
We conjured him out of nowhere. He's no longer the unsung hero of the Kings for 13 years in a row. And that's a joke I made. Two podcasts in a row for the long-time listeners. So Lewis, he scored the shorthanded goal in game one. He was, I think, number two in the reader rankings after game two. And tonight, again, not besides winning the possession, it's the same kind of things that have made Lewis sort of a playoff standby for the Kings in past season. It's the smart plays, it's the responsibility on defense. Anytime the Sharks were breaking in, I don't think there was ever a time where Lewis was the guy responsible. He switched to the fourth line center position going into today's game because Nick Shore went to the bench. And I don't know how much time. Yeah, I don't know how much time Lewis ended up playing, but he obviously didn't stay on the fourth line and didn't stay on the bench with Clifford and with Versteeg. Lewis only played 9 minutes tonight, actually. So, maybe that's not updated, but he didn't
11.
Get a
He's
whole
played
lot
11
of time.
With a couple being on the PK.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. But yeah, I think he's. After a season where I can't really recall too much that he's done, he's been playing really good hockey. And Dwight King, who we've been raking over the coals for the last couple months, I thought was good tonight as well. Still very low impact. Wasn't on the ice for any goals. He wasn't on the ice for any goals. But he played the kind of game that is going to keep him in the lineup after a couple weeks of us saying, why is he still in the lineup?
Yeah, I think that the biggest thing Trevor Lewis did was, at least at even strength, he made Chris Versteeg a positive possession player. That's that's good. I mean, I was looking at the numbers, you know, before the game, and, you know, not by a little bit, by a ton, Versteeg has been the worst player in this series. At least in terms of, you know, possession metrics and whatever. So take that for whatever it's worth. But, yeah, I mean, I think having him on the fourth line and kind of shoring that up. Wow, nice. Good one. Sorry, Nick.
Solid.
Yeah. I think that, you know, that means something. And that's, you know, I think that's pretty important, too. I really think that I don't know if this is like – people talked – when they went and got Milan Lucic, like this was the kind of guy that fit well with the Kings, and that never really made a lot of sense to me. I think maybe they thought, you know, they were talking about the Ducks or something like that, a team that, you know, more of like the aggravate-y type, you know. Like what Lucic does is the same shit that Corey Perry does, you know, or Ryan Kessler does or whatever. And I know he has been, generally speaking, a pretty good possession player. He's been good. I just think that this kind of the stuff that he's trying to goad the Sharks into doing just is not going to work because it's never worked. It's never the Ducks try to do it and have had very little success doing it. And I think honestly that you know, other than obviously his good play on the, he needs to reel in that kind of crap because it's just it's going to end up with him in the penalty box more than it's going to end up getting into the Sharks' heads. At least in my opinion, kind of curious to hear what your perspective is on him as, you know, as a player and not just his possession stuff, but all the other stuff that kind of comes with the Milan Lucic package.
Yeah, and that is what did happen tonight. Lucic spears someone well behind the play in a third period with the Kings already sort of clinging to this tie and puts us on a terrifying PK. I think Lucic has been pretty much as advertised coming from Boston, and he was advertised very highly. Like, we were pretty skeptical, not necessarily that he was going to be a decent player, but that he was going to really, again, fit with the team or be a positive contributor, at least to the level that Justin Williams was. And he has been very good this season. But in the playoffs, in, I think, the All the Kings Men podcast, the Kings main podcast, was talking about this as well. Finding the right line mates for Kopitar has always been a key to past success. And when Justin Williams left, Lucic was the guy to sort of fill that in. And I think he's been better with Carter. and it sort of left Kopitar searching for guys to play with. And of course, Kopitar still got his 70 points. But Lucic, when he's not scoring and when he's not making great passes, he made a couple really good passes tonight, including one to Kopitar on his goal. He sort of looks for ways to make an impact. And when he goes too far, then you start seeing the negative aspects of Milan Lucic. So I don't have a problem with him playing as much as he does. I don't think he's been a standout through the series so far. But I think with what he does bring to the table, and the Sharks have clearly been drilled not to get goaded into anything. In 2014, I think it was game four where they sort of lost composure towards the end of the game, and I think it set the stage a little bit for the rest of the series. We're not going to see anything like that in the series. We're going to see Hurdle tackle Brown because we've had that boiling over for about 3 years. But the Sharks clearly aren't going to let themselves get goaded into taking bad penalties.
Yeah, I mean, like the very first time Lucic came on the ice in this series, and obviously I only remember this, or maybe the other Sharks fans, he skates over to Marc-Edouard Vlasic and taps him on the leg that, you know, he's had injured. And, you know, I don't know what he said, but I assume something to the effect of, you know, we're going to murder you, because that's been the Kings' game plan, you know, basically in the last two playoffs. So I assume since Jared Stoll isn't there to make a bad hit, that Lucic will do it. Obviously. I don't actually think Jared Stoll ever did anything intentionally. I think he's just an idiot, not a bad person, just to be clear.
And I had forgotten until about 10 seconds ago that Lucic's very first game in a Kings uniform was against the Sharks, and he gets ejected for going after Logan Couture at the bench with the Kings down 5-1. Like, that's...
Oh, you're right. Whoa, I forgot about that. That's right.
I'm sure it endeared him to many Kings fans, but it just looked like, you know, someone who was sort of desperate and looking for a way to make an impact, even if that impact is potentially getting himself suspended and causing the opening night to end in a flurry of gloves flying across the ice. So that was a very negative first impression for his sort of long-term future with the team. Like, it's great that he's willing to beat up the Sharks, but if he's not going to help the Kings win, then what's he here for?
That doesn't
but
matter.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, to his credit, he's played well this season. He's given us a reason to maybe want him to be re-signed, although the money's going to be really tricky. So we'll see.
I think he's going to get signed by too much money by an idiot. That sounds likely to me. Like, he seems absolutely like the kind of player that the Vancouver Canucks want to overpay for, which would be great. I think that would be a net positive for the Sharks and the Kings if the Canucks want to waste cap space on Milan Lucic. That sounds great. Kings can find another player.
We'll hate playing against him, as always, but the Kings can find someone for a couple million less than what Lucic is going to get. Having said that, if he comes back, I'm for it at this point. And I say that knowing that he is incredibly unlikable to other teams.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting that he reminds me of like a, oh God, I hate even saying this, like a Rafi Torres light, nowhere near as awful or evil as Rafi Torres is, but the same kind of player where it's like, man, like, do they not know they're good? Like, you know, you don't have to do any of the extra stuff because you're good. You know, I never really understood why guys like Lucic think that, like, oh, I got to go out there and make an impact. Like, dude, you're not John Scott. You're going to get in the lineup. You're fine. You're playing good hockey. So why don't you just go play the good hockey and we'll leave all the other crap to, you know, I don't know, some guy who's going to get 6 minutes. Like, let Chris Verstappen do that. What else is he doing? Yeah, Mike Brown. Right. Exactly. Like, what are these guys doing? Let them go do that. Mm. They're not doing anything positive anyway.
So the I was going somewhere with this. So give me a second. But Lucic, I guess. Oh, I got it. So Lucic, again, is the guy who really needs to make an impact, regardless of whether he's being effective or not. A guy who's been like that in past years that hasn't done as much this year is Dustin Brown. I think the hits are down. I think the sort of physical impact is down. And he's played well this season without scoring, which has been his MO for the last couple of years. But it was strange seeing Brown with the big hit in overtime. Not that you would expect other guys to do it. Maybe Braden McNabb, I think, has sort of taken the mantle this year as the guy who comes up with a big hit out of nowhere. But it was strange seeing that kind of momentous play from Brown, because I can't think of any other time in the last few months where a physical play by Dustin Brown has really sort of changed the game. And I don't know if that's made him less effective, but it's, as weird as it is to say, especially to a Sharks fan, it's almost out of character with the way Brown has played the last couple months.
What I think about Dustin Brown is that he's learned something. He's changed his game, and I think it's been in a positive. Like, Joe Thornton used to be a guy that liked to, you know, he's huge, right? Like to put on hits, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, as he got older, he started doing that less and less. You know, Joe Thornton is big and it's physical, but it's not in the same way that, you know, Dustin Brown used to be in. And I think that that's a positive change that Brown's made to his game. Because to me, anyway, as someone who's maybe a little less emotional than other Sharks fans, I really don't think that Dustin Brown's MO has ever been to be a dirty player or to make hits that hurt guys. I think that what's happened in recent years is that he has slowed down, and it's taken him some time to really adjust to, you know, what his body is telling him. And I think that he's made some positive by not trying to go for those hits anymore. I think he's kind of diverted his energy into other more positive ways. I think that's just good for him. I think it's just good in general, because he's not doing things that his body's not letting him do anymore. That to me is the change, and I think that that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think Brown, too, and the losing a step is a good point, because his other favorite thing, aside from throwing big hits, was to sort of try to use bursts of speed to go around the outside, do that little between-the-legs move that Kings fans know and love and hate at the same time. And that has sort of faded away, too. Like, Brown has, for better or for worse, turned into a guy who's going to be out there for, you know, 58% of the shot attempts, and he's going to either make your third line way better than it has any right to be, or make your first line less productive than it should be. But it's, as we sort of get to the point where Brown might be taken in an expansion draft too, it's interesting to see that change in him, and it's interesting to see how the Kings' various core players have sort of adapted as they get older. Joe Thornton, like you said, has adapted in his own way, but he's also remained incredibly effective. And with him and Pavelski, that's been sort of a full season thing, right?
Yeah, that's been a thing for a couple of seasons now, maybe two, three seasons. Yeah, that's been a thing for a while. I died on that hill a long time ago. The split up Pavelski and Thornton Hill, it's gone, it's over. So yeah, that's a thing.
Yeah, it's Pavelski still listed as a center, was a center for quite some time, and now Pavelski third line center, Burns as a forward. Some interesting things that were really hotly debated a couple years ago for the Sharks that now, you know, like you said, debate is over. Hill has been died on, so on and so forth.
Yep. Yeah, I think at this point there have been other decisions made building the team that have kind of locked us into that mold, basically. So, right.
Mm-hmm. So with Joe Pavelski, he has, 38 goals this season?
Yeah, something like that. I think he just missed 40 again.
Yeah, I think this was the first he's averaged 2 points a game in the playoffs against – or 2 points a game in the playoffs against the Kings. He only got one tonight, even though it was all the points that were available to him. I know. It's awful. So, Pavelski, was there a sense after that first 40-goal season that this was going to be Pavelski, or was there sort of a sense
there was skepticism? Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think what we didn't take into account when we talked about that was that so many of his goals and so many of his points come in the power play. And that's something that can be a little bit more consistent because the power play is consistently so good. I think the other thing that we took for granted was, you know, how freaking incredible Joe Thornton is. And that's something that we have done forever, and it's something we will continue to do forever. That's really the difference, is that, you know, if you were to go back, I did this at some point and looked at how many, you know, goals were like Joe Thornton had primary assists on from particular players. And I know that Pavelski, even despite it being kind of a pairing that has not been going on for that long, I know he was pretty high up on the list. We've seen this before. Joe Thornton has done this before with other Sharks. This is not like, you know, something kind of crazy that's out of the blue or anything like that. But yeah, I think that, you know, we thought that there was going to be some regression in terms of his shooting percentage and whatever, and it just hasn't happened. And I think that, one, the power play, two, Joe Thornton's passing have, you know, really everything to do with both of those things.
Right. And we go back to Jonathan Chichu scoring 50 goals.
Right.
That was...
Yes. That's the poster child for this movement. Yes, correct.
Yeah. So,
yep.
So Thornton... Yeah, happy to bring up Chichu. So Thornton still locked in until next year as well. Pavelski locked in until 2019 at $6 million a season, which is pretty good for your 35 to 40 goals a year. The Sharks have got a very, you know, I'm looking at their cap space, and I'm looking at the guys that they have to re-sign next year, and I'm a little bit envious because the Kings are in a crunch, and the Sharks, I don't think you're going to face those difficult decisions next season. And they also are spending less money on their goaltending as well because of Martin Jones. So there was this, a big sense of the window is closing for the Sharks. And right now it doesn't feel like that at all.
I think my opinion is that the Sharks basically have this year, they have next year, and then we'll kind of see what the front office does. Really, a lot of it has to do with some of the decisions that are going to be made this offseason, not in terms of signing UFAs, RFAs, whatever. We saw what happened the last time, you know, the Sharks lost to the Kings in the playoffs. And if Doug Wilson does something like that again and loses his mind again or whatever, they won't be able to withstand that. It's honestly a miracle that they were able to withstand it the first time. So I think that, yeah, the Sharks have a few years where they'll be competitive and they'll be good. And I think that the reason that the Sharks have a better cap situation than the Kings is that the Sharks haven't won. And that's just the way it works now, you know, that you,
yeah.
Especially in an organization like the Kings where they're, you know, want to show loyalty to certain guys, sorry, Mike Richards, but to not Mike Richards guys, you know, right? And that's just kind of the way it works. But, you know, I think one of the things is that, you know, while I know some fans like to, you know, make fun of, like, the Dustin Brown contract or the Quick contract, you know, I think don't we all kind of know deep down inside that we're going to have another lockout in 3 years and most of those contracts aren't going to matter anyway? That's, you know, to me, that's like almost like a non-issue. What the Kings are doing and what the Blackhawks have done, I think, is the right model, right, where it's like, yeah, okay, you're going to spend a lot of money. You're going to take on some bad contracts, but you're going to win now. And then, you know, when the Coast contracts do turn over and are bad,
right,
you know, you rebuild and retool and you go do it again. So, yeah, I think the Sharks are in a good position for the next few years. But, you know, once the Paul Martin contract looks crappy, and it will – you know, and once the whatever they re-sign Joe Thornton for, because they will, once that looks bad, you know, once we get to that point, then it'll be maybe time for kind of a retool. And then maybe Logan Couture will finally take over the team just like he always wanted.
Oh, you know what? I'm excited for him. I'm excited for him to finally get that chance.
Aren't we all?
So, yeah. So enough about the future for now, mostly because as a Kings fan, I'm a little bit scared of the future. Although, as you said, like I haven't talked to any Kings fans who are really upset at the way the cap situation is now. It's just sort of an accepted fact. But as
right.
long as this is, quote-unquote, the year, the most common observation I've seen about this series, and I've seen it in past years, and we saw it in 2014, is that the winner of the Kings-Sharks series is the favorite in the West.
Yeah,
do you get
I agree
that
with
sense?
That. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about you, but not a single other team in the West is particularly scary to me, or at least not as much as the Kings are, personally.
Yeah, the big thing for the Kings especially is that the one team that might be, well, aside from the Ducks, who are in a 2-0 hole at the moment, the one team that on paper should be a big concern for the Kings is the Blues, and the Kings and the Blues have a long and storied playoff history in which the Blues dominated in the 60s and 70s when the Kings were and the Blues were expansion teams. And then in recent years, it has been a mismatch. So I hate to do that, and I hated to do it in 2014 when everyone was saying that the winner of the Kings-Hawks series would have a cakewalk in finals, because you never want to assume anything. But I think the Sharks, even, you know, the result of this game notwithstanding, have maybe been the most impressive team in the playoffs. They've definitely been the most impressive team, I think, in the West. And with Nashville and Anaheim, it's not going to be a sweep in the second round, but Nashville is
there's
a
no
team
reason
with a lot
either,
of flaws.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, Nashville is not an impressive team to me at all.
Right. And when we asked before the series who Kings fans would rather face, and it was, I think it was like 60% would rather play the Predators. I think that, in hindsight, that's probably even, it should have been more votes for the Predators. But the Predators, really, the only argument was that they've had success against the Kings this year. But obviously the Sharks have too.
Meh.
Right. And in the Central, it's been, well, the Central is a bit of a mess at the moment. So the Minnesota Wild are brutal, and now they're back in the series against Dallas. So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at every team, Minnesota is bad. I don't think they're going to win that series. Dallas has $10.5 million of crappy goaltending. Chicago's just not who they've been, you know, for the past several mm-hmm. years, which I know we said last year, but whatever. I picked the Blackhawks to win that series because I just can't in good faith pick the St. Louis Blues to win anything. And I know that's superstitious and stupid, but it's the Blues, man. You're going to put your faith in the St. Louis Blues. Brian Elliott plays goal for them. I don't know, man. They just don't. They're whatever. You know, I assume if the Kings play them, they'll beat them in 5 games just like they always do, and then that'll be it.
Oh, I hope so.
Even from the East, I think if you look at the most impressive team, it's probably the Penguins, and they just lost to the Rangers, like the New York Rangers of New York. I mean, I don't know if you've watched them play this year, but good Lord.
I mean,
that's
Henrik
harrowing.
Was always going to steal one, I think.
Right.
And, yeah. Or, and I actually didn't watch any of the game today, so I don't know. But the Penguins are scary. The Capitals they rolled over the Flyers today. They're going to be scary.
Boy, did they.
In a number of ways. So it's going to be, I don't think that the East champion is going to be a pushover in any fashion this year, but it's going to be, whoever wins the series is going to struggle with the weight of expectations, I think.
Mm. I mean, do you think that would be a problem for the Kings? I can't imagine. I know that they've kind of been, allegedly the underdog the 2 times they've won the Cup, but they can't possibly care about something like that, right? I wonder if
no.
any of these guys do. I mean, they're professional athletes, you know, whatever. What do they care?
Right, and I don't mean to say struggle under the weight and they'll collapse against Nashville in Game 7 because the moment is too much for them. But I do think that there's an expectation with both of these teams that, and this was what the Ducks were going to face before they went down 0-2, is that they were expected, if they made it past the first round and out of the California gauntlet, that the rest would be a lot easier. And it's going to be interesting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be nothing new, you know, for the Sharks, who have been under incredible expectations every single year for, except for last year, maybe for forever. I think this is the first year, really, that the Sharks were able to come into a series and just not to, and to really actually be underdogs, at least from, you know, media perspective, which I think we both know doesn't really mean anything, of course. But I think that that's probably true. But I also think that, you know, it's, same as it ever was. If the Sharks don't win the Cup, it's going to be a disappointment. And that's been true, you know, fairly unfairly for forever.
And that's the ironic thing about this season, is that the Sharks did come into the series as maybe not a clear underdog, but as an underdog. And if they make it out of the series, they sort of stop being an underdog. So you got the one season where the Sharks come into the playoffs as sort of not dealing with the favorite tag or the the expectations on that level. But if you beat the Kings in the first round, then suddenly those expectations get transferred to you.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, coming into this series, I felt very little anxiety or stress about, you know, like if the Sharks don't win this series, it's okay because they lost to a team that I think is better than they are. If they win this series, it's like, oh, great, here comes the anxiety of old, where it's like, oh, my God, if we lose to another crappy team, we've lost to another crappy team, you know? To me, there's, like, honor in losing to a good team, and losing to, like, the Predators in the second round. God, that... Wow, that sounds pretty bad.
to make it... For the Kings or the Sharks to make it out of this bloodbath of a series and then fall to Nashville in six would be a disappointment, I think, for everybody in the state of California.
I agree. I think, though, that we do underestimate how hard this series is for both teams. Yeah, you know, I know the Kings have come out of this series and, you know, won one of the past, but it's not easy, you know. This is a very demanding series, physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever. I mean, the idea that coming out of this that you're supposed to come out without any battle scars is kind of it's kind of funny in a sport that is so obsessed with battle scars. That's always been a weird thing to me, that we don't, you know, we don't really take those into consideration as far as, you know, once you get to the second round, how much you have left in the tank from the first round and so on and so forth. But
that'll definitely
be a factor.
And the Kings, the last two times they've had to play a series after facing San Jose, they wilted against the Blackhawks in 2013 because they had nothing left. And then in 2014, they do win the first two games against Anaheim, but they also are pretty well outplayed in those two games, I think, overall. And they managed to get two results, but, you know, there's one in overtime and there's one where they score 30 seconds in and manage to hang on after that. So, and I don't remember what the Sharks did after the 2011 first round. Did they lose in the semifinals or the conference finals?
The conference finals. That was the they beat the Kings, beat the Wings, and then got swept by the Canucks.
Right, and that series I don't think had quite the reputation that it does now at that point, probably because they hadn't had their playoff history. But I agree with you. I think it is going to be difficult, especially if the Predators manage to go home and finish off Anaheim, which I don't think is going
to
happen.
They get to sit around and hang out for a week. Yeah,
exactly.
I agree.
Exactly. And and if you have that and you have Pekka-Rinne continuing to play well, then it's a very tricky matchup to navigate.
Yeah, I think that first series with the Kings in 2011 was not really like the other ones have been. That was a Kings team that I still think was very talented, but was still kind of, you know, feeling out what was, you know, what the deal was. And not to mention, I mean, the Sharks won, what, 2-3 games in overtime in that series, something like that.
They have the –
it wasn't easy
comeback
either.
From four down. Yeah.
They come back from
four down.
Yeah.
They win one, I think – did they win game one in overtime? Maybe game two. I think
I think the Sharks went up – yeah, anyway, whatever it was. But, right, yes, exactly.
Sure. But your point is well taken.
Right, that series could have gone, you know, if the Kings win another one of those games or whatever in overtime, right? I mean, didn't, like, Ben Ferriero scored a game winner, I think, or something like that. And that's, you know, I mean, nobody's heard of that guy before.
I think that was actually against the Wings. That might have been one or something against the Wings.
It was Devin Setoguchi then that scored the game winner against the Kings, and then Joe Thornton scored the series winner. Okay, all right, fair enough. There were some pretty nice moments for the Sharks in that series, and then the stupid Canucks steamrolled everything. But right, like we said, that to me is not the same as these. That's kind of like that was like a coming of age type series for the Kings. I think after that they kind of like knew that they had played well enough to really be in that series, and after that it's kind of, you know, that's when they became who they were after that, at least to me anyway, you know, from an outsider's perspective.
Yeah. So there were two more things I wanted to get to before we talked about the rest of the series, and I think we've got about 20 minutes left. So first of all, Martin Jones, somehow we managed to go about an hour without really talking about Martin Jones, who I think has, at least in the first two games, was decidedly much better than Jonathan Quick. And even tonight, I thought Jones was really steady for the entire game. Maybe not spectacular, but has he lived up to your expectations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think to me, my expectation was he was going to give the Sharks, you know, basically league average goaltending, and I think he's absolutely done that. He's been very, you know, very steady, very good in goal. He's been fine. He's been good. And I think that's basically what the Sharks are, you know, are paying for, basically. They're paying about the amount of money that's requisite to being like, yeah, pretty good. I think he's been very good in this series. He was good tonight, you know. I know that obviously he'll end up with the worst save percentage, but, you know, Jonathan Quick, as he has wont to do, put himself into some pretty vulnerable positions tonight, and, you know, was bailed out, which, you know, I'm not trying to use that as a criticism so much as to say that, you know, like that's part of how goaltending works.
Of course, that's what he does. Yeah.
Rarely puts himself in those kinds of positions, mostly because he can't. To me, the biggest difference is that Jonathan Quick is extremely athletic, and so he can, you know, do a lot of things that Jones just, like, his ceiling is higher, right? But he'll also do stuff that's like, you know, there are a couple times Quick played the puck tonight and we're just like, oh my God, if Jones did that, I think I'd have a heart attack, you know?
Right.
So Jones isn't going to do that kind of stuff, but he's also not going to make the kind of spectacular save that Quick can make, so, which I think is fine. They're paying him like nothing, so I think that we're getting, you know, fair value for the deal, basically.
And that's always been the backup syndrome with Kings fans too. And you mentioned that Jones is a very stable goalie. And the last couple backups, Bernier was like that too when he was here. It was people, you know, maybe didn't know what they had with Quick. At least I didn't know what we had with Quick until 2012 happened. And Bernier's style was always such a contrast, being very calm and collected, and his positioning was always very predictable. And Jones was very similar, and Enroth has been a little bit less like that because he's a smaller goalie. He can't really afford to play that style, but it's, you know, as a fan, if you don't know too much about the goalies, you always want to see the guy who looks more calm, and Quick is obviously not he doesn't fit that bill, but he's also earned the trust, and of course then Bernier goes to Toronto and fights with James Reimer, who is now in San Jose, and I don't think we're going to see him this series based on the first three games, but Reimer's also provided a boost with that tandem as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Reimer stopped the bleeding. Alex Stalock was just so bad. Which,
oh, man.
man, good Lord. Oof. Which, you know, it's like one of those things where one of the crappy I told you so's, you know, it's like, yeah, he, of course he was bad. You know, he had like a 9-0 something in the AHL, and spoiler alert, mm-hmm. that doesn't generally translate that well to the NHL when guys are actually good. But yeah, I think, and you know, Sharks fans do this too, right? Where, you know, we had Niemi the past few years, who admittedly was not very good in the playoffs, which no Sharks goalie has ever been. But the idea that that you know, like, that he wasn't good, or he put basically up the same regular season numbers as Jonathan Quick did over the past few years, which is, you know, kind of amazing when you think about it. and kind of, I guess, speaks to just the, yeah, the way we are with where the playoff, whether it's the playoffs are the only thing that matters, or that we're just not good at evaluating goalies as fans. I think that, you know, we get so caught up in the aesthetic of it all that we don't actually look at the numbers, which, you know, is probably a good idea.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that Quick was really, really good tonight, despite the fact that he went, I think, into Nevada territory a couple times to cover pucks.
There were a couple times where it was, you know, it's like, all right, buddy, yeah, maybe it's time to, you know, to stick in the net a little bit. Yeah, there are definitely a couple times when he's, you know, down on the ice or whatever. And I think the thing is, though, is that he does that stuff, and I think we shouldn't look at him in a vacuum. You know, we've got to remember that the Kings defenders and other forwards, they know. They want him to do that. And so they're good at kind of tying up the puck when he's down on the ice. You know, it's like there were times when, like, the puck wasn't just, like, loose waiting for the Sharks player to pop it over him or something. You know, there are a lot of sticks in there, and I think that, you know, they play well with that kind of style, so it's not as big of an issue as I think we'd like it to think, basically.
Yeah.
And he made that great save on Tierney, too, which was, you know, a game saver, really, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, the Tierney save, that's the refresh my memory on that one.
That's the one where Spalling gets behind the net, throws it out right in front, where Tierney's just basically standing there, and he gets it with his glove. You know, not
and
a
I was
great
thinking
shot,
that,
obviously. I mean, it's a horrible
line,
but whatever, still.
Sure, and as that's happening, I'm thinking, great, I've been watching Sharks fans yell at Spalling for weeks now, and he's going to be the one who sets up this this game winner that all but buries the Kings. So I'm glad that didn't happen for obvious reasons. And then the one other big save for Quick was in overtime on Donskoy, where he gets a very similar chance to the one that Pearson got and puts it in pretty much the same place. And Quick, maybe not the most convincing save. The puck sort of squirts out after the whistle, but he comes up with it. And now you, instead of talking about the Sharks being up 3-0, you're... You know, you see a lot of Quick praise on the timeline, and he deserves it, at least for today.
Right. Yeah, so, I think that that's like it was very close to the Steve Mason experience if that puck gets through, basically. Right. Exactly.
Chris Mason. He's been working hard for 2 years to turn around his reputation, and now he's got to deal with that. Goaltending is tough.
Yeah, sure is. No kidding.
So, I guess there's not too much left to talk about. The one thing that I did want to ask about, and we'll keep this short because I don't know how much there is to it, but the Sharks home record versus the away record. Everyone was saying, well, it's not a series until the Sharks win one at home, which is counterintuitive. Do you think there's anything to the difference in the home record versus the away record?
No, the big difference is that a lot of those home games were when Vlasic was hurt. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost a lot of games without their best defender, as one will do. Right. If you look at their possession numbers are much better at home than they are on the road. So they just haven't gotten the goaltending. And
that is interesting.
Yep. So, yeah, it's fine. I mean, they played well tonight. I think tonight they had they were better in, like, you know, whatever, score-adjusted Fenwick or whatever, and they weren't in game two. They just happened to win this, or lose this one and win the one, win game two. So, you know, whatever. It's fine.
Right.
People like to
complain
about it and, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and I think overtime in either direction was a fair result tonight, although the Kings might have been feeling a little bit fortunate after that third period. So we'll end by talking about Game 4. It's 2 days away. Thankfully, there's no back-to-back shenanigans in this one. Do you?
I know. Thank God.
And you don't think the Sharks change anything except maybe a fourth line swap? I don't think the Kings change anything going in. Do you see a very similar defensive struggle?
Probably yes. I think that we'll see if the Sharks are able to make any adjustments based on what the Kings were able to do tonight. But I think that it's going to be a pretty similar game. you know, I think the difference in the first two games versus this game is that the Sharks were winning a lot of those puck battles down, you know, behind Quick's net in games one and two when they dumped it in, and they weren't necessarily doing that tonight. I think that's really, like, one of the big differences, and that's just a kind of a, you know, sometimes you make plays, sometimes you don't make plays, and, you know, welcome to sports. I think probably pretty similar. I think if it's not like that, if the game is more like it was played in the first two games, I think the Kings are probably in trouble. But I think if it's more like this, then, you know, like every game this year, it's basically a coin flip.
Yeah, and there was, I think, a lot of danger of this one really going into an open back-and-forth game, more in the vein of the first two, especially when the Sharks score 30 seconds in. And I think it was a really good time for the Kings that they were able to settle things down. I think the one thing that I expect to change for the Kings is I expect more from the Carter, Vucic to Foley line if it stays together. Not for any really good reason or any good signs from today, just that I don't think Toffoli can stay at the level he's been at the last couple games, which is just probably the worst he's been all season. So I expect a bit of a change there. I don't know if it's enough to win game four, but I'm expecting more goals, and that makes me a little bit nervous.
This kind of game is the kind of game the Kings want to play, this 2-1 win. I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers, but they must have the most 2-1 wins of any team in the NHL this year.
Yeah, Daryl Sutter always says it's a 3-2 league, and the joke for a lot of the past years here has been, well, maybe now it's a 2-1 league.
Maybe it is. There's probably something to that.
It'll be a 2-1 league in the next couple of years if it isn't already.
No kidding.
So we got our overtime game. The Kings finally managed to win one against San Jose in overtime. It wasn't decided on an offside challenge, which, praise the Lord, we were not far away from that with Pearson having to tag up there. But it was a good game, and it's going to keep the rest of the world saying that they hope there's four more games of this, and the rest of the Kings and Sharks fans saying, well, maybe we can end it in game six this time.
Yeah, right, exactly. I think this is a great series for a neutral and absolutely terrible for every Kings and Sharks fan. I think it's always one of those things where I've always said that no matter who wins, nobody's having any fun.
Yeah.
Until they win, obviously.
I think that's the best way to sum it up. So, any last thoughts?
No, yeah, I'm excited for a nice day off tomorrow, and then the nerves will resume in full in game four, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I'm excited to see what opinions people come up with when it's not just a ton of, oh, it's a 3-0 lead again, because it was going to get
very, very dull pretty quickly. Yeah.
It would have been pretty funny for a while, and then it would have just been, okay, well, maybe we get to game four now.
Yeah, right. Once hockey Twitter runs out of all of the mediocre jokes tonight, it would have been a really, really long Tuesday, I agree. So at least we get a new narrative.
So what you're saying
about,
is you're happy.
No, I am not. Don't lump me in with the idiots. No. Don't. I legitimately, I did a Q&A on Facebook today and got more than six people who asked me if it'd be better if the Sharks lost tonight. And God help every single one of those lost souls, you know.
Well, they got their wish, and it's going to be
for them.
Yeah, right. So it'll be a good game for either way. So
absolutely.
So thanks again for doing this. There was for all the listeners, there was brief consideration of us recording during overtime. We'll see if it goes to double overtime at some point in the series. Maybe we'll pull that one out just so you can hear us cry on air for a while. But for now,
it's got to be better than any of the broadcasters we're listening to.
Well, if you got Randy and Jamie and I got Nick and Jim, then I guess we're both happy.
I guess so.
I guess.
Miss Bob, though.
Yeah, he'll be back soon.
Don't we all?
Yeah, Nick is thankfully terrific, but it's a little bit different. So
it's not the same.
Yeah, and Randy and Jamie have gotten a lot of praise nationally, too. I think a lot of it being compared to the other quote unquote local team that's been doing broadcasts, which is the Philadelphia team.
They're bad,
I think,
man.
Especially compared to them, Randy and Jamie have come off a little. And again, I haven't watched them this series, but I've had the usual flex of annoyance when they've been on NBCSN. I haven't had another choice, but they, you know, it could be much, much worse, I think, for Kings fans.
Dude, yeah. Imagine if the Ducks played on a Comcast affiliate. Good Lord.
Oof.
Wow. That would be the worst. That would actually be the worst.
That was
thing
a chore yesterday.
Oh, man. I powered through it to watch the Ducks lose, but, man, it was difficult.
Oh, boy. So, rather than talking about John and Brian,
Brian
for 4 minutes, we're not going to talk about him, I said. We're going to end it there. Thanks again. Depending on how this series ends, probably either way, I'm sure we'll have a postmortem. But for now, enjoy the rest of the series. Get ready for 4 more inevitable games of this.
I'm going to need to go buy more beer.
All right. Finish the beer, go to sleep. Thanks again, and thanks again, everyone, for listening.